Lecture 2, Ancient Espionage.
In the ancient Middle East, the great city of Jericho, believed to be the oldest continuously inhabited site on Earth, stood near the Jordan River in what is today the West Bank. The city of Jericho was a stronghold with proud and tall walls all around. But it had one vulnerability, perhaps one that the king of Jericho did not fully appreciate. Inside the city was a scorned woman, Rahab the prostitute, who was willing to help foreign spies whose aim was to prepare to capture the city of Jericho. When the foreign spies came to her, she agreed to help them. Rahab aided them in evading capture by the city troops, her own people, and helped the foreign spies escape again with their information about the city of Jericho in return for a promise, the promise that Rahab and her family would be spared when the city was taken. Why did Rahab do this? Was it resentment against how she'd been used? Was it hatred of her fellow townspeople? Was it the desperate hope for a new beginning, a social reversal, in which Rahab would be a member of the elite, not a member of the exploited? Was it greed? The foreign spies were of a different religion, with a different god. Was this a gesture with religious meaning? In this lecture, we begin at the beginning, by trying to discern the earliest forms of espionage and covert action. These have been tools of politics and war from prehistoric times to ancient Egypt, India, China, to classical Greece and Rome. Rich myth, legend, and historical fact have surrounded these activities from the start. Espionage and intelligence have been around since the beginnings of political organization, and it's for this reason that spying has been called the second oldest profession, after that of Rahab. We will see that it is enlightening to trace these earliest experiences because given human nature, they from the very start establish durable patterns and strategies that will recur later, echoing into our own times. While the earliest espionage act, the first act of espionage, is lost in the mists of time, we can discern a fascinating phenomenon which starts early, which will recur in our course, and that is a linkage to religion. In a way, this makes perfect sense. Religion is about the seeking after discernment, the quest for deep understanding. And religious teaching seeks to provide explanations of the secret, the unknown, the supernatural. Ancient societies had a strong sense of mysterious interactions between their world and the world of gods, with divinities on a regular basis walking about and interacting with mortals, but always in disguise. In that sense, in older traditional societies, shamans were scouts into other secret worlds. Whether in the animistic religions of Siberia, or among the medicine men of the Native Americans, or in the Amazonian rainforests, shamans sought to function as guides to the spirit world. They would engage in trance journeys as their own special missions into these outer realms. In later ages, as religion grew more organized, priests were often the ones who guarded knowledge and knew how to read and write. Thus, priests would be keepers of crucial and often secret intelligence and information, whether that was religious or secular in nature. This linkage of religion is one that we will see later again, especially in our next lecture on medieval spying, but also much further on in an extended sense when we discuss the great faith vested in ideologies in the 20th century, ideologies that have been aptly described as political religions for the fervent faith or fanaticism they could command. A key question to raise is when espionage or intelligence activity do first appear in the historical or written record. We have a good candidate. Maybe later an even better evidence will be found, but this is a good candidate. It's a clay tablet from Mesopotamia written about 2000 BC. This clay tablet was found along the Euphrates River, and it's a letter. It's a letter from a commander named Banum, writing to his warlord and giving him crucial information. He informs his warlord that villages of foreigners along the border of their state have been exchanging mysterious fire signals. And Banum was going to set out to find out what those fire signals meant. What a cliffhanger. What an opener to a Mesopotamian thriller novel in the making. What we would not give to know what happened next. But the record does not allow us that knowledge. Other early appearances in the historical record show another theme that we'll see recurring frequently, and that is a tie to diplomacy, the relations between different states. Some of the earliest diplomatic correspondence that survives details secret interactions between ancient Egypt and the neighboring Hittite Empire around 1320 BC. These Hittite sources that survive involve correspondence with the widow of the boy king Pharaoh Tutankhamun. His widow writes to the Hittite Empire, asking whether they couldn't find from among their elite a new husband for her, now that her husband, the boy king, had died. And indeed, speculation continues to this very day about whether Tutankhamun's death was in fact a murder. There might have been good reason for his widow to be afraid and concerned. In the records that survive, the Hittite prince ordered one of his officials to go to Egypt to get more information, to find out if this was a serious undertaking or a plot. And eventually, one of the Hittite prince's sons was sent to follow through on the marriage, but died on the way. This is a surviving record we have of a covert operation. Staying for the moment with the Middle East, it hardly needs saying, it's so obvious, that the Bible is full of spy stories of many kinds. And a key point that's revealed as we read those stories is that intelligence work is portrayed and understood in these stories in markedly different ways, showing overall a conflicted and ambivalent evaluation. Let me give some examples. The prophet Moses, leading his people out from Egypt in the Exodus, sent spies out to scout out the lands before them as they prepared to enter Canaan. Moses chose 12 men for the task, one of each tribe, to spy out the land, to determine the best routes that the people should take in their incursion, and the character of the settlements they would encounter there. The spies, it's recorded, returned with a report that the lands were very fertile, and they came back carrying very tangible proof in the form of fruits showing the fertility of that land. But the people at large doubted the report of the spies, and thus, the scripture writes, there continued years of wandering in the desert. About 1200 BC, after the death of Moses, a new leader came to the fore, the new leader Joshua. And he again set his people advancing on Canaan and sent two spies ahead of them into the great city of Jericho. This is the story with which we open this lecture. Once there, they hurried to the house of a prostitute, Rahab. This is what today would be called a safe house, a place where their presence would likely not attract as much attention. Rahab hid them from the king's forces and denied knowing where they were when the king demanded that foreign spies should be turned over. Rahab, in fact, had hidden them on top of the roof of her house, under bundles of flax. Rahab's rooms were along the city's wall, so that the spies were able to escape over the wall, directly over the wall afterwards. Before they made their escape, however, Rahab pleaded for help. She said, "I know that the Lord has given you this land. Everyone in the country is terrified of you." Rahab explained that all had heard of the divine aid that the Israelites had been given in their wanderings, and concluded, "We were afraid as soon as we heard about it. We have all lost our courage because of you. The Lord, your God, is God in heaven above and here on earth. Now swear by him that you will treat my family as kindly as I have treated you." Thus concluded her plea. As the spies left, they promised her that she and her family would be spared when the city was captured. Rahab was instructed what to do to mark off her house as that which was to be spared, and that was to tie a red cord to her window as a secret sign. But she was warned, if she told anyone of the activity of the Israelite spies, the entire arrangement would be void. The spies then returned to Joshua and reported, "We are sure that the Lord has given us the whole country. All the people there are terrified of us." Eventually, Joshua and the Israelites captured the city. Its walls, formidable as they were, collapsed when the trumpet blasts of priests caused them to fall. At that point, Rahab and her relatives had been gathered in the safe house, and they were spared. And the scripture concludes that, as a reward, her descendants have lived in Israel to this day. Another biblical story paints a woman agent or spy or covert operator in very different terms, not as one to be celebrated. And that's the biblical story of how Samson, an Israelite champion and strongman, was betrayed and brought low by one of the prototypes of the femme fatale, Delilah. Samson was a strongman who had slain 1,000 Philistines, the enemies of his people, with a donkey's jawbone. It was capable of other great feats of strength. But he fell in love with a Philistine woman, Delilah, and the Philistine kings bribed her into finding out the secret of his tremendous physical power. Samson deceived her 3 times, but then finally, when she kept questioning about it over and over again, finally admitted to Delilah that the true secret of his power was his uncut hair, a sign of his dedication to God. When Delilah lulled him to sleep, Philistine agents came in, cut his hair, and Samson was captured and blinded, and then paraded as a sign of the humiliation of the Israelites. In the end, however, he had his revenge. He was brought before a crowd of 3,000 Philistines and their kings, and at that point, humiliated before the crowds, he prayed for one last measure of the strength he used to have for purposes of revenge. And in a suicide mission, he pushed against the pillars of the building, causing it to collapse, killing himself and all of the Philistines. The ultimate scriptural trope of secret betrayal comes to us from the Christian New Testament. When a disciple of Jesus, Judas Iscariot, handed over his teacher to the authorities for the price of 30 pieces of silver. At night, Judas had come to Jesus and greeted him with a kiss of betrayal, a sign that this was the man who was being betrayed, and Jesus was seized by the soldiers. This scene became a classic reference for betrayal, the spy as traitor. And such a figure also was often seen as a doomed traitor, for the scriptures write that later Judas repented and hung himself, unable to undo the deed that had led to the death of Jesus. These biblical narratives carry very contradictory views of espionage and secret operations. This contrariness will be communicated, as we'll see, to Western civilization at large. We get a very different and contrasting view of spying from other civilizational traditions, in particular Asian contexts. India's classical texts, especially a guide to royal rule, the Arthashastra of Kautilya, contain many references to spying as a useful practice. The Arthashastra is supposed to date from around 300 BC, written by an ancient Indian statesman. It is an exhaustive guidebook to how to rule a kingdom, including how to be a saintly and virtuous king, how to hire good ministers, probably people like Kautilya himself, how to build good forts, how to lead an army, how to train elephants, how prostitutes should be supervised, all manner of administrative information and bureaucratic wisdom. And prominent among these tips is the role of spying. A good king, this text instructs, should proceed to create spies. And there then follows a long list of kinds of spies. Spies who stay in one spot, spies who wander and move about, merchant spies, spies who poison, begging women who are actually spies in disguise, and especially relevant to the connection to religion that we've mentioned, spies disguised as holy men or holy women, ascetics, who wander the countryside witnessing to their religious faith. Among these holy men or holy women were hermits. Now, on the face of it, being a hermit doesn't seem very helpful to the enterprise of espionage, but in fact, such hermits could be spy masters who stayed in one spot and controlled a network of disciples in a larger region. What's crucial is how the spy is presented in terms of the qualities for which they were to be chosen. A skillful person to be a spy should be capable of guessing the mind of others and, strikingly, possessed of foresight and pure character. What a different way of viewing the spy from the Western tradition. a person of foresight and pure character. Such spies were to be recruited with honor and gold. They were to be sent out to observe the king's own officials secretly to uncover abuses. Other spies included a group that we don't really know as much about as we'd like to, called firebrands or fiery spies. And they're described in pretty mysterious terms in this text as brave desperados who go out to fight elephants and tigers for money. Such firebrands or fiery spies must have functioned something like a personal security detail or bodyguards. They were supposed to be employed in holding the royal umbrella over the king or the royal shoes, all the while observing those who had come to meet with the king. Now, if other spies were of pure character, one group was not, and those were poisoners. They were apparently not held to the same high moral standards. They were described as having no trace of filial affection, being very cruel and indolent. What's fascinating is from the testimony of this ancient text, spying in ancient India seems to have been very effectively organized, not just ad hoc or spontaneous, but institutionalized. There was to be an institute of espionage which collected information. And information that came into the institute needed to be verified from three independent streams of intelligence to assure its validity. We talked in the previous lecture about tradecraft and built-in redundancies to independently confirm intelligence. Here's an ancient example of this insight that has lasted and retained its validity into our own times. In the classical text as well, spies were to be set to counterintelligence tasks. Spies were to hunt down enemy spies, thwarting their attempts at intelligence gathering. The instructions of spying in times of war in this ancient Indian text also encompass the use of poison, sabotage, and psychological warfare. Spies in time of war were to be infiltrated into the enemy's state, and there they were to go about their secret work, spreading mutual suspicion and dissent among the populace. This too was to be done through the spreading of malicious rumors, or of disinformation, or the judicious application of bribes to discontented subjects or officials. Spies were to find ways of posing as wine merchants to distribute poisoned wine, or food vendors plying toxic food. There were also some remarkably specific pieces of advice. It was suggested that smearing the eyes of valuable animals with muskrat blood was supposed to make them rage and would cause stampedes among horses or cattle. I don't know if this is true or not. I probably wouldn't recommend it, though. Spies also were disguised as snake charmers, and thus they would be able to release their reptiles among the enemy in a decisive moment to cause a panic. Spies were to work as arsonists in the rear of the enemy army to create chaos with their fires. Even psychological warfare was urged, as spies were to go to the enemy's capital and then blow trumpets there and proclaim loudly that the country has been conquered. In the disorder, the enemy king might be assassinated by other bands of spies. Finally, another legendary figure in Indian folklore was that of the poisoned damsel, who was supposed to be a woman who from childhood had been fed small and then increasing doses of poison so that she herself gradually became immune to them but would be toxic to any man who was lured into becoming her lover. As with Delilah in the Bible stories, the notion of the fatal female was a prominent theme here as well. In the vast Persian Empire of around 500 BC, internal intelligence gathering was a function within an entire and very elaborate administrative setup known as the satrapy system. Given the huge expanse of the Persian Empire, individual governors or satraps ruled over smaller units of the empire, often with remarkable independence. And the king would simply have to trust them to rule well, because the king might be removed from his satraps by days or weeks or even months of travel time. For that reason, the Greek historian Xenophon, who wrote about the Persian Empire, reports that there was a system, he said it was set up by King Cyrus the Great, by which individual satraps were subject to inspection, open or secret, from their king. Yearly inspections would be undertaken to help satraps who needed assistance or to correct abuses. The officials sent out would be called the king's brother or the king's eye, euphemisms for these inspectors. Xenophon adds another fascinating closing note, which is that sometimes satraps would receive news that an inspector was on his way, but then no inspector would arrive after all. Maybe the inspector had been there in secret. One implication of this is that the mere awareness of being under observation might cause satraps to be loyal and dutiful. Many other Greek authors write of the eyes and ears of the king, leading historians to believe that there was a corps of royal spies at work. And such inspectors, as well as just general communications in the Persian Empire, benefited from a tremendously well-constructed network of royal roads, which allowed them to achieve amazing speeds given the conditions of the time. This entire road network has been estimated at about 8,000 miles or so, and also involved a network of horse relays resembling the Pony Express of the Wild West, with stations for fresh exchanges of horses for messengers, each at the distance of one day's ride. Clearly, this was the quickest way in which a human being could travel in these days, according to Xenophon. Now, by our own standards, this would still seem achingly slow. And this is tremendously important. Here's one of the great differences in espionage of the pre-modern age versus the 20th century, the speed of communications. Only with the advent of radio would so-called real-time intelligence, delivered as an event was taking place, finally be possible. Think of what Cyrus the Great would have given for a radio network at his disposal. Apart from the technology of communications, human and psychological insights were also at work in the Persian approach to intelligence. The Persians were famed for their cunning on this score. The wonderful Greek historian Herodotus records an incident of how the Persian king Xerxes treated Greek spies in a very unusual way. The Greeks had made up their own internal quarrels and had sent three men to Asia as spies to find out just how strong their Persian enemy was. They observed the Persian army, but were captured by a Persian general and condemned to death. When King Xerxes heard of their capture, he countermanded the death sentence and had them brought to him. The Greek spies explained to Xerxes what it is they'd been sent to do, to observe the military power of the Persians. And Xerxes then had them escorted all around his camps, shown the infantry regiments, the cavalry, everything. And then he sent them home to Greece, where they were sure to report all they had seen. Xerxes explained his action thus. If the spies had been put to death, the Greeks would have lost three men. And they wouldn't know that Xerxes' army was even bigger than was commonly believed at the time in Greece. Killing the three men would not much affect the war effort, but having the word of how great Xerxes' army was would spread far and wide, and perhaps the Greeks would surrender, saving him the expense of even marching on them. In this case, Xerxes was fighting using psychological warfare, and that most potent of all weapons, the truth. Special mention should be made here of the Chinese tradition, as embodied by the Chinese general and philosopher of war, Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu is a shadowy figure about whom we do not know much, and there's a big debate about when he precisely even lived. We might say that this was roughly in the late 6th or early 5th century BC. Sun Tzu penned his insights in terse, careful form in a classic entitled The Art of War. It's a short set of maxims and insights with later commentary added by later generals and military thinkers. And the book is still studied avidly today, not least in military academies around the world. It's said to have influenced Chairman Mao Zedong's conduct of guerrilla warfare in modern times. The final chapter of Sun Tzu's work is devoted entirely to espionage. And its importance was underlined from the beginning with a maxim that all warfare is based on deception. There is no place where espionage is not used. Sun Tzu urged that one should always deceive the enemy, offering bait for his destruction. One should feign disorder when one was well organized. When one was active, one should pretend to be passive. When far away, one should convince the enemy that one was near. One should pretend inferiority and do all these things to achieve surprise. Turning specifically to spying, Sun Tzu urges that there is no place where espionage is not used. The key is to gain foreknowledge. To use spies effectively, one must oneself be subtle, wise, and delicate. Self-knowledge is key. Success is assured for those who know the enemy and know themselves. Sun Tzu then categorizes five kinds of spies: local spies, Inward spies, this means essentially enemy officials. Doubled spies, we would say doubled agents. Doomed spies, who are fed false information and sent to their deaths. And surviving spies, those who return with information. Among his concluding recommendations, Sun Tzu urges generous payment for spies because of their potential strategic importance. This points to a fascinating motive for the emphasis on spying, economics. Sun Tzu emphasized the immense expense involved in regular warfare versus the judicious and delicate work of the spy that was cheap by comparison. We'll observe this phenomenon recurring in our course, the great lure for policymakers of espionage and special operations as a seeming silver bullet and appearing to be relatively cheap, as we'll also see the reality is often far more complicated. Turning westward again to the ancient origins of Western civilization, we still need to examine the legacy of classical Greece and Rome. These cultures give us a paradigmatic story of a covert operation, the legend of the Trojan horse. This story is mentioned by Homer in the narrative of the Trojan War and was further expanded on by the Roman poet Virgil in his Aeneid. The story went like this. After 10 long years of the Greek siege of the city of Troy, the city was finally captured by trickery. The Greeks built a huge wooden horse outside the walls of Troy and then sailed away, or seemed to. Inside the hollow horse was a unit of top Greek warriors, waiting for the appropriate moment. One Greek was left behind when the others sailed away to convince the Trojans that this strange construction was an offering made to the gods for safe travel home. The Trojans rejoiced at the lifting of the siege and prepared to drag this trophy of their victory into the city. A Trojan priest warned them that this is not something to be trusted, but they disregarded him. The Trojans even dismantled part of their gate to allow the trophy in. Once in the city, when night fell, the concealed Greek warriors poured out, opened the fortifications to the returning Greek force, and the city of Troy fell. This legend is the origin for the saying, enduring to our own times, "Beware of Greeks bearing gifts," a parallel to the saying, "If it sounds too good to be true, it is." In a fascinating way, there's modern resonance here as well. Today, some computer viruses and malware that can be accidentally downloaded by an unsuspecting user are sometimes also called a Trojan horse, speaking to the enduring lessons of this myth. Not just in legend, but in practice, the Greeks were very familiar with spying, as we already saw in the incident of the Greek spies sent to Persia. Spartan society, in particular, developed a form of internal spying, remarkable for its brutality. To keep its large slave population of helots under control, the Spartan state appointed young men at a particular stage of their military training to act as a secret police to ferret out attempts at slave revolts. These secret police were empowered to kill any helot that they caught involved in these activities. And to make this kind of special murder legal, every year, in a special ritual, the Spartan state declared war on its helot population. This chilling practice of internal surveillance eerily points forward to the practices of totalitarian states of the 20th century, where secret police not only kept subject populations under watch, but in a sense made war on them with policies intended to purify and perfect the people at large. Later, Alexander the Great used postal censorship to check morale among his troops, even during his great and famous conquests. The tradition relates that when Alexander was besieging Persian forces at Halicarnassus, he became aware that there was a lot of grumbling and discontent in his army, and he wanted to find out why. So he made an exception of his usual rule of not allowing soldiers to write home so that important information wouldn't fall into enemy hands. In this case, he allowed them to write home. When they'd written their letters, they were all collected, the letters, by a messenger who set off for Greece. But a few miles from the camp, the messenger was met by Alexander and his officers who read the letters. And those who had written back with disaffection or bad morale were removed. Obviously, only the literate ones or those who could write hire a scribe to write for them were targeted. So I guess one lesson is that in some circumstances, being illiterate and miserly can be an advantage. The Greeks also practiced early and primitive forms of coded messaging. One tradition has it that Greek military commanders had staffs of exactly the same width and length, and they could send messages on scrolls between each other. It had to be wrapped just right around the staff for the correct message to become visible, but many historians are loudly skeptical of this. In another example, one might mention that they would also insert messages into an animal bladder and slipped into an oil flask so that it could be retrieved at the other end after having been smuggled to its intended destination. This sounds very messy. Just as tricky but more painful was the anecdote in Herodotus of a ruler who shaved the head of a slave and had his message tattooed on the scalp of the slave. After the slave's hair had grown back, he was sent on his mission and reshaved on arrival to reveal the message. Romans were also keenly appreciative of the importance of intelligence. Julius Caesar was an enthusiastic user of military intelligence, and he used it also in his invasion of Britain in 55 BC. But ultimately, he was not quite so careful in spying on his political enemies as his assassination was to prove. I want to conclude with a final example, a famous example of espionage activities by Scipio Africanus, a famous and earlier Roman leader. Scipio would send envoys to negotiate with the enemy and would send along with them centurions pretending to be slaves. In one famous case, this almost led to disaster because one of those centurions was recognized by someone on the enemy's side. The quick-thinking envoy then proceeded to beat the disguised centurion, and the cover of that disguised centurion held because the enemy concluded that no true Roman officer would have allowed himself to be treated thus. Romans, thus, were willing to endure humiliation for the cause of intelligence victory. We've seen in this lecture a record of ambivalence, and this points to a lasting legacy of how, in particular cultural contexts, espionage has been praised or condemned. In the course of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, we will start to see the beginnings of the growth of a modern state and modern diplomatic practice, and we'll trace also how espionage intersected with them in our next lecture.